Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Mark Goddard is an artist, musician, writer, photographer, and music agent from the UK. Initially, Mark worked as a music manager and events planner. In 2009, he created the electric pop tribe Legion of Many with his elder brother, Jeremy Goddard. The band went on to perform live on national TV, break into the UK singles chart with their debut single, Now We Are Stars, headline the prestigious sporting club in Monte Carlo, and appear at numerous music festivals across the UK. After Mark's journey took him out of the music industry and out of the UK, in 2015, Mark returned to England and went back into the music industry, working for a new music library, which evolved into a music publishing company called Rogo Music. In 2018, Mark musically reunited with his brother Jeremy on a new project, The Brothers Goddard, a boisterous live rock and roll and heavy blues act that takes influence from a plethora of older artists that inspired them growing up. In addition, Mark founded Distraction, an electronic music club night in London with Brazilian DJ Petora. In 2019, Mark met online art gallerist Sasha Bailey, son of renowned fashion photographer David Bailey, who expressed interest in some old 35mm film photos Mark had taken when he traveled around the States back in 2002 with Jeremy. Impressed with what he saw, Sasha encouraged Mark to start writing about his experience from the trip to give context to the photos. Motivated by Sasha, Mark took the time during the pandemic to start writing Losing El Dorado, Searching for the Soul of America, documenting his journey all those years ago. Up next on Celeb Savant, discussing his first book, Finding El Dorado, and his journey in the entertainment world, we've got Mark Goddard. Where do we find you in the world and how are you doing?
Hi, Barrett. I am in London, England. It's a beautiful sunny day, actually, and I was on the bike for the first time in a while, enjoying London in the sun.
Okay, let's rewind. At what age did you think, cool, you want to be in the music or entertainment world, creative world, and how did that journey progress to where we are currently?
I grew up in a very musical family. So my dad was a piano player and singer, and had a jazz band. Music was always in the blood. My brother's 4 years older than me. He's a singer as well and piano player. So, I mean, I was playing in my dad's jazz band from, you know, 11, 12, 13. But I always enjoyed drama as well. And I was very creative, and did a lot of art and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it was something which, I don't know, I mean, as a family, we just sort of, my uncle, for example, he was a Christian rocker back in the 70s. So I don't know, it's in the blood. It's something I sort of fell into, I suppose. I've always done.
You were in the jazz band with your father as a teenager. What were the next steps?
So my brother and I, so we grew up listening to Ray Charles and like the great music of the 1930s and 1940s onwards, well, 1920s onwards, really. And my brother's a little bit older than me, and he became a professional musician at the age of 15, playing the piano and singing. But we started to discover this, a lot of music my dad listened to, he sort of didn't really listen to a lot of late 70s stuff. So we discovered things like Earth, Wind & Fire, Talking Book by Stevie Wonder. And I was actually talking about this yesterday, Led Zeppelin 4, but we discovered them on vinyl. And it felt like it was our music because our dad was sort of into stuff which was, you know, a little bit older. But whereas I think a lot of people of my age, I was born in 1984, like their dads and mums would listen to that stuff and that was their music. But my dad was into, like, he was always into stuff which was like pre kind of the Beatles, really, I suppose. But he loved lots of great blues and jazz. So he taught us to play jazz and to play blues and to play by ear. But my brother went off and he went off to university and he was playing with bands and had a band and all that sort of stuff. And I carried on playing. But I went off and studied architecture when I was 18, 19. And then it was only after I'd sort of finished going through the university that I sort of embraced actually becoming a sort of professional musician. I came back to it. My brother, by this point, had gone to America and was living in New York. And he'd been a professional musician since he was 15. And I was sort of semi-professional. But like, I decided, my brother and I joined together and we started a band called Legion of Many. And that was 2009. But I came to it from this like direction of having gone through art school, basically, which I subsequently sort of found out from reading various rock biographies that that really wasn't actually that rare a route to becoming a pop star or you know, being involved in popular music.
Yeah,
there's sort of like two sides to the way that people approach music like that. And you know, all your sort of people from like Pete Townsend to The Faces and, you know, Ronnie Wood and people like that. I think a lot of these people studied at art school, and I was at architecture school, I was at the Bartlett UCL, University College London. And it was a tough course, but it did sort of open my eyes. And then my brother was doing a different type of music, because we were really back when we start, both of us were into funk and soul really, and rhythm and blues of the late 70s and early 80s and into disco. And he had been off on the sort of R&B soul thing, and then he decided to go into sort of house music, and I came on board and said, look, I brought the sort of creative direction into what we were doing. And that was 2009. It really sort of, I basically switched my career on its head. And I was at the Royal College of Art at the time. So yeah.
Are you still doing the band Legion of Many?
No. Yeah. So Legion of Many is on hiatus. Okay. We had I say like we were a comet, had a brief period of flying high, and then it disappeared. Yeah, we were all sort of very high concept fashion led band, wore spandex feathers, leather, all that sort of stuff. And it was really good fun. But we've since then, my brother he now lives in Barbados, and he's a piano player out there. But we do play together. We play with a band called The Brothers Goddard. And that's what I've been playing more gigs as well by myself. And that's a more sort of blues. I call it heavy blues. So it's late 60s, Peter Green, that sort of vibe, which is kind of what I like playing on the guitar. So, yeah, I mean, when we are together, our last official Legion gig was in 2021 in Barbados, actually. It was actually a lot of fun. But we don't often perform as Legion. It's quite a different set to the sort of stuff that I play with Brothers Goddard. Okay. But then my dad's band, Dr. Jazz, I still play with his band when he has a gig.
Okay, let's look at your first book that you've now published, Losing El Dorado. Was it always at the back of your mind? What was the journey to create this book? Let's unpack that whole experience.
Yeah, so it was good to give you a little background into, you know, where we came from musically. And, you know, my brother and I listened to a lot of this music, which we really resonated with on vinyl. And I implore people to go and listen to music on vinyl if they can, because it has such a visceral quality. But when I was 18, just finished my A-levels, so high school, around the world. And my brother said, he was 4 years older than me. He had gone over to America a couple of years before when he was at university. And he'd come back, and it was 2002. And he said to me, look, we should go to America. It was a sort of pipe dream. Let's do a road trip. Let's go back to the source of the music that we love and we grew up listening to. And so when I finished my A-levels, he was like, look, we'll buy a car. He'd done some research and he said, we'll buy a car. It's cheaper than, you can't even hire a car. Easily, you can't go from state to state. We couldn't back then. And he said, we'll go over to America. We'll go down. We'll drive from Boston down to the Deep South, down through Memphis to New Orleans. I just finished at A-levels, and literally 2 weeks afterwards, I had a little bit of life savings, not a lot, and some interest-free credit cards. And we decided to go over to the States, and we went looking, and I went with my camera, and we went looking for a car, and it took us a week, to be honest. We stayed with some family friends, and it took us a week to find something. And we were actually right at our wit's end, to be honest, because we'd been looking for this car, and we couldn't find anything, went through a whole thing. But what what happened was we had this amazing journey in 2002, so it's somewhat over 20 years ago, and we've somehow found this amazing Cadillac Eldorado for $1,500, which was, you know, not that much these days, back then, but these days it'd be a lot, but it was sort of a, you know, 2 to 1 or even less than that in terms of exchange rate. So we bought the car, and then we suddenly felt like this car had a presence and a personality, and we quickly dubbed him the Mighty Rufus. And we got asked by some girls we met on the journey, what's the name? And I immediately just said Rufus. My brother said the Mighty Rufus. But we started, I had my manual SLR camera and film camera, and my brother said, we were taking photographs of ourselves to begin with, and he said, why don't we put the car in the photographs rather than ourselves? So I did this whole series. It was a 2-month journey, and we went from Boston to New Orleans, went through New York, went through Philadelphia, went through Washington, down through Tennessee, into Memphis, Nashville, and then down through the Mississippi Delta to the heart, you know, the home of the blues, and then down to New Orleans. And then we went across to Austin, Texas. And then from Austin, we decided not to cross the desert because we didn't think the car would make it. And we went up north towards Chicago, which I think in hindsight, I'm really glad we did, because we went through the Midwest and went up Route 66, and we spent a good amount of time in Chicago. But to answer your question, because I haven't answered your question, is I sat on these photographs for sort of 18, 19 years. I came back with this amazing bevy of photographs of the car in iconic locations across America. And I thought about doing an exhibition when I got back, and I went straight to art school, actually. I went off and did art foundation. And I showed a photography teacher, and she was like, well, it's just pictures of America. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah. And I thought, this if I ever do anything with these photographs, it has to be done in the correct manner, because it was a kind of an epic journey, and it really did inspire both of us. My brother subsequently moved to America a year later. But in 2019, my brother got back in touch with me. He was living abroad, and he said, you know, you need to do something with those photographs, Mark. You know, like, it's been, you know, it's almost 20 years since we did the trip, and like, no one's seen them. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I think I need to do a show. I need to do a photographic show. So that was my initial intention. And I had no intention of writing a book at all. I never even crossed my mind. Some people say, oh, I want to write a book. I never felt like I needed to write a book. From Legion of Many, I basically worked as an A&R guy in the music industry in publishing and for small independent record labels. So I had this other career. Anyway, I was also a nightclub promoter, and I was running a night, and I met a guy called Sasha, and we got chatting, found out he was involved in the art world. And he said, oh, great. Well, what do you do? And I said, well, I've got this photographic show, which I want to put on, of me traveling across America 20 years ago in a Cadillac. And he's like, oh, I'd love to see that. And I showed him the photographs, and he went, wow, these photographs are incredible. Come and meet me next week. Let's talk about this properly. So we met up, and I started explaining the whole story to him. And he's like, this is amazing. I subsequently found out as well that his father was David Bailey, the famous fashion photographer. And Sasha inspired me. He said, look, I think he was running his own online gallery. He said, I think you should start writing about this, though. He's like, these photographs are great, but without the story, or without the stories attached to them, they're not lost, but they don't have the same pathos and power. And he said, and this was just like in January of 2020, so pre-pandemic. And he said to me, it was just about to kick off. And he said to me, you should write 1,500 words per city. And so I was like, oh, wow, okay, yeah, that's an interesting idea. So the whole world shut down. I actually got ill with COVID. And it was what I started doing in my COVID recovery. I was ill for about 2 months. But I just started writing initially in the voice of Rufus, but then I realized that it was actually just better, more stronger to come from me. Mm-hmm. And it within about a week of starting it, I realized that basically this was not going to be a 1,500 words per city. It was going to be a proper long book. So yeah, and then it all just like it just poured out of me, because it was this story there are many stories that my brother and I had told over the years about this journey. And for us, it sort of was one of those things which we referenced a lot. And informed our musical appreciation in general and understanding of American music, which was quite, was really radically changed by going to America and going back to the source of the music.
How long did that journey take?
Yeah, that was 2 months. So we actually arrived on the 4th of July, 2002, and we left on Labor Day weekend. So it was the perfect American summer. You know, we literally came into Boston as the fireworks were exploding. So that was quite interesting.
How long were you in each place for?
So, yeah, it depended. So, obviously, in New York, as it turned out, in New York, we spent quite a long time. We spent 2 weeks in New York. We spent a week in Boston, in Springfield, looking for Springfield, Massachusetts, which is like a good, you know, hour and a half from Boston. But yeah, I mean, we spent 4 days in New Orleans. We spent 5 days in Memphis. It tended to be, if we found people in those cities who showed us around, we were having a good time, would stay. You know, we had no fixed itinerary.
Oh, okay.
We just knew we had to get back. Somehow to get back to England, I was going to art school, and Jeremy had to finish his last year of university, so we needed to be back in England by the start of September.
How long did it take you to write the actual book?
In terms of actual writing it, I wrote it fairly quickly, but not. It took. I mean, from beginning in sort of March of 2020, and then I released it in 2023. Got March, so 3 years, but it was sporadic, and I got the bare bones of the story together by November of 2020. But then I lived in Barbados in 2021. I was out there playing with my brother, playing music. I was playing guitar. He was singing and playing the piano, and we were playing loads of bars and restaurants. Things were open at that point. So I was doing that, and I was also surfing, and I'd surf in the morning, and I'd write the book. I'd been made redundant, so I had a little bit of redundancy pay, which was paying for my life at that point. And I did a lot of rewriting in that period through till August of 2021. The easy part of the book is that the story which Jeremy and myself took, I know, you know, I could, it's not, that's quite an easy thing to write. The difficult part is, one, making that interesting, but two, when you're doing a nonfiction book, and it's a nonfiction book, you've got to qualify what you say,
yeah,
and fact checked, and that stuff takes ages. And I was learning the whole time as well. And for us, like the book is sort of a conversation in some ways with my brother. Like we did a lot of it through conversations we had over the phone, and then he would have like an hour long conversation, and then I'd just go and write a chapter.
Yeah.
As a result of that conversation. But it's an interesting thing. And I think that what we felt was like we were trying to celebrate the greatness of American popular music when we came back from America in 2002. And I've tried to do that in the book. And I don't shy away from the problems of America, which are many. And you know, it's going through a tough time at the moment, as the rest of the world is. But I really wanted to join the dots is what the best way to describe it. I wanted people to understand how the tree emerged or evolved into modern popular music as we know it. And each city I look at a genre which makes it, you know, famous for that one particular thing. So for example, Philadelphia, I talk about Philly soul. And we went and saw Maxwell, who was really big at the time, had a big album. We saw him performing at a place called Upper Derby at the Tower Theatre, which, this is the sort of thing where then I suddenly went on, you know, gone deep dives in the internet and all sorts of things, and found out that it was a massively successful, but famous venue, which David Bowie played at, and Genesis played at. And it was really, it was Phil Collins. It's an iconic venue. So like, I didn't know that. We didn't know that when we went there. We just thought it was just the venue, but actually it had a real history. And that, when you read the book, it was that there's a lot of stuff in there, which I just didn't know myself. And I've done the research and sort of gone, oh, okay, wow, that really is important and interesting as well. So it was finding stuff within that. But then the actual process of, I think for a lot of writers, the key part is the rewriting and the editing process.
Naturally, by knowing about these various aspects, about the various venues or various places at the time or before the time, it would have enhanced your or changed the experience of the journey. But do you think it was necessary to know about it before, or not necessarily? Because now doing the research for your book has now enhanced that experience by knowing these things at this point.
Yeah, we did try and find historical places. Obviously, like we went to Sun Studios, for example, and Stax. So the little bits of information, and actually it was quite, we probably could have found more information. Like we didn't go to Muscle Shoals, for example, which we probably should have done. We didn't. The world was a different place in 2002. I think that's a lot of what the book is about this transition from the analog to the digital. And I go into depth about this and how America has changed as well and culture's changed. And I travel around America in 2021. So there was always a part of me which felt like we missed out on doing the desert. You know, it was like, because that's like the Thelma and Louise type vibe, you know, easy rider, you know, go across the desert. Everyone's like, oh, you did go across the desert. It's like, no, we didn't go across the desert because the car was about to die. Yeah. And we didn't want to get stranded in the middle of nowhere. But we had no Google Maps. We had a very, you know, just a standard old what you call now a burner phone. We had a mobile phone, but it was just like you could only make bad text messages and make a phone call. And we used a Randy McNally Atlas. And I really feel that actually, yeah, it was actually, in some ways, it was, I like the fact we had no itinerary and that we didn't necessarily know where we were going or what we were looking at. It meant there was a certain element of wonder. But I do think that it is useful to have a little bit of knowledge about, well, maybe we should go to this place because this is like, you know, it wasn't, there was no tick boxes. And I think that it would have been interesting to know more about these places. But then I think maybe we were focusing on, I was looking as a photographer more, that's when we were traveling, I was thinking more about, well, is this going to be a good place to take a photograph of the car? So yeah, it's a good question. I don't really know what the answer is because I think that there is elements of not knowing about stuff means that when you do find stuff out, there's a surprise and interest. But if you do know too much, then it can be a bit like, well, I've just read this.
So a story of mine is that a number of years ago, I was going on holiday. I was going to Amsterdam, Lisbon, and Madrid. And I was coming back to South Africa on the Tuesday. And on the Friday, I was going to see my favorite artist in concert back home. And I recognized a few weeks before my holiday that I was more excited about my concert than I was about my holiday. Now, previously to this, I would always get details from the travel agents, you know, from books, et cetera, what there was to do at the various destinations. Now, for this specific trip, I knew I had hotels in Lisbon and Madrid, and I was staying with friends in Amsterdam. But what I decided to do this time is not do any research. I decided to just arrive at my destination and see what there was to do and then go from there. Because I knew if I knew what I was doing or I had planned what I was doing in the morning or afternoon, I'd be in the morning doing whatever, not really participating in that experience, thinking about what's coming later and tomorrow, knowing that the concert's coming up and just sort of not be in the moment. So by doing what I did and not doing any research or not doing any planning around it, it allowed me to stay in the moment and experience so many things that I would have not necessarily have done or been aware of in the moment if I had planned or done research. So I totally get with what you're saying.
We had two things. We had a rough guide and a lonely planet, and they were invaluable. But, you know, they didn't always put us in the right places. Like we stayed in Elvis Presley Boulevard they said it was the cheapest place, best place to get reasonably priced motels in Memphis. And we found one, which was $19 a night, called the Graceland Inn. Yeah, it was an interesting space. I write about it in the book, with all the characters you can imagine in the wrong side of the tracks. And when we actually met up with a friend is a great, he's now a very good friend of ours, a guy called Josh. He and his buddy Tony were just shocked that we'd stayed in Graceland and in Elvis Presley Boulevard. And we were like, well, it's in the rough guide, you know? They're like, it's like the worst place in Memphis, man. Like, you know, Graceland, interestingly, when Elvis bought it, was sort of like almost in the countryside, you know? It was green fields around it, but now it's very much in the suburban sprawl. Yes. Or urban sprawl of Memphis. And Memphis has, you know, got terrible, terrible crime problem. So, you know, but it was also useful to know, like, I did the trip in 2021 without a guidebook, and I was driving most of the way. I was with my girlfriend at the time. And I think I kind of missed a few things because I didn't look at the guidebook, you know, or didn't have a guidebook. And so you do miss things if you don't have any information at all, especially if you're only in a place for like a day or two. You know, yeah. Sometimes you've got it. It's good to have like a focal one, maybe one focal place. I think doing one thing which very much took us to where we were going was concerts. You know, we were so like, I remember Jeremy looking on the internet, like really, like this is like, you know, 2002, you really go to the internet, you go to an internet cafe.
Yeah.
And I remember him writing down a piece of paper, like working out who was playing where in America on what dates and where could we get tickets and how did we get there. And also, I mean, the tickets as well, you couldn't buy the tickets online. You'd have to go and physically buy them from a ticket shop.
Yeah.
But we worked out a sort of route based around, well, this guy's playing here. So Lenny Kravitz is down in Texas. Well, maybe we should go to Texas. And we found out that like the Isley Brothers were playing in Brooklyn, so we'd go and see them, and we got the tickets for Maxwell. We didn't know Maxwell. I don't think we knew that Maxwell was playing. We arrived in Philadelphia, we're planning to go to South Street. We go downtown Philly, just arrived. It took us like 4 or 5 hours. It should have taken us 2 hours. We missed the New Jersey Turnpike, then the Mass Turnpike. We ended up taking a very peculiar route into Philadelphia. We got there and we saw this poster for Maxwell, and we'd been listening to Maxwell before, and I was like, Maxwell's playing tonight. And so we just drove over to the venue. We didn't know where it was. And we just drove. I had no idea, you know, and we got lost, you know, and we found it, and we walked in and we got the tickets on the door.
I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 8 years, I know your answer will be different every time because there are millions of them. I recognize that and I understand that. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. But if you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists once we finish this conversation, what would those 5 songs be and by whom?
Yeah, I mean, something like Georgia on My Mind by Ray Charles is just a phenomenal piece. I mean, to be honest, anything by Ray Charles, almost, but definitely of that period in the late 50s, early 60s, what I'd say, you know, that sort of stuff I absolutely adore. And it's just beautiful music and just so timeless. Yeah, I think maybe, you know, on a sort of blues, like more rocky side, I mean, I'm a massive Peter Green fan of the original Fleetwood Mac. So something like Man of the World is a great song. It's very, like, kind of tragic. But top of my brain, you're just saying what's the top of my brain? It's something, a song by Prince, you know, I Want to Be Your Lover, or I mean, Purple Rain's a bit obvious maybe, but it's a great track. Interesting about Purple Rain is it's actually a live recording, but it's got that energy to it, and it's such a fabulous track. And then, yeah, James Brown, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. I saw James Brown on one of his last concerts in the UK. He played at the Essential Festival in Bristol in like 2002, around the time, maybe 2001, around the time we went on the journey. But I would love to have seen James Brown in his heyday. So that's four. Fifth one. I reference 450 songs in the book, so I'm just going to pick one at random. Definitely. This Suspicious Minds by Elvis. You know, Elvis Presley, for me, that was one thing which we became, after doing this journey, we very much became huge Elvis Presley fans. I say in the book, we basically started becoming adherents to the cult of Elvis. But I think going to Graceland and seeing where he lived, it felt like his ghost was still there, or he was still there.
Yeah.
But the sadness, and actually the film was really sad. I mean, the recent film, I mean, just Elvis's story is so sad.
So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So as a final message, what would you like to say?
I think people should try and, you know, explore the world and keep their horizons open and their options open, their mind open to new experiences, but also like listen to great music and love it and hopefully play it. And if you learn to play it, and you know, you don't have to be able to play it. You can just love it. Just love the greatness of great music, and go and listen to vinyl. Listen to music on vinyl. It sounds like you're in the room.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.